For 9 years now, a private developer has been working to get approval for 130 wind turbines on Cape Cod. Local opposition has been strong. Now, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is poised to decide whether the country's first offshore wind farm can be built there. Sean Corcoran reports from member station WCAI.
The waters of Nantucket Sound were unseasonably calm when the Interior Secretary stood near the bow of the Coast Guard vessel Ida Lewis recently on his first visit to the proposed wind farm site. Here, the wind typically blows at an average speed of 19 miles per hour, making it popular with recreational sailors. But during Salazar's visit, not even a brief gust threatened his trademark Black Stetson, as he announced that after nearly a decade of review, it was time to decide the fate of the project called Cape Wind.
And I think the worst thing that we can do for the country is to be in a state of indecision, and this application has been in a state of indecision for a very long time.
Cape Cod is that arm-shaped peninsula that extends out from Massachusetts, and Cape Wind's closest 440-foot-tall turbine would be 5 miles to its south in Nantucket Sound. It's shallow here, less than a foot deep in some places, which is one of the reasons Cape Wind officials insist it's the region's best location for an offshore wind farm. Whether that's true or not is now up to Salazar, and no matter what he decides about this project, Salazar says offshore wind power is coming to the United States.
But as I've always said, with respect to renewable energy on the onshore, it's important to do wind energy in the right places. That is the critical question that we're addressing here at Nantucket Sound. You know, is this the right place for wind energy or is it not?
For the past year, Cape Wind has been on a winning streak with court victories, state approvals, and a mostly favorable environmental impact statement from the federal government. Mark Rogers, the communications director for Cape Wind, says that since it first was announced in 2001, the billion-dollar project has garnered strong statewide support with its promise to meet two-thirds of the Cape's electricity needs while offering energy independence and fewer greenhouse gas emissions.
Cape Wind has wider and deeper support than any energy project in the history of New England. Leading environmental organizations, labor unions, trade associations, and just across the general public.
But most local officials here oppose its location in an area used by fishermen and boaters, and the local Chamber of Commerce says Cape Wind is a threat to the region's only industry, tourism. Until his death last year, the most prominent opponent was Senator Ted Kennedy, whose family life on Nantucket Sound was well documented. Now, the loudest voice against the project comes from two local Native American tribes.
We're the Wampanoag, people of the first light, and it's our responsibility to greet that day.
That's Bettina Washington, the historic preservation officer for the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead on Martha's Vineyard. She says the project would infringe on the tribe's religious and cultural rights by interfering with their view of the rising sun, and it also may disturb archaeological evidence of tribal life.
The waters now cover what we know were ancestral homelands that we walked. We lived there. We went to the edge of those shores to fish, and we interred our dead in those lands that are now covered by water.
The strong Native American opposition may present the final hurdle for the project. Last fall, the Wampanoag successfully petitioned to have Nantucket Sound declared eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places, making the permitting process more difficult. Salazar met with the tribes for a sunrise ceremony during his visit to the Cape. He says he's taking their concerns seriously as he wades through all the issues, with an eye towards releasing his decision sometime in April. For NPR News, I'm Sean Corcoran on Cape Cod.
And to continue in the ocean vein, we're joined by Flora Lichtman, the video producer for Science Friday, with the video pick of the week. Flora, what you got?
This week, yep, more ocean news, and it's sort of a good news story, which I think seems rare for ocean stories. The backstory here is that coral obviously are facing a lot of threats today.
Right. There's been this thing about coral bleaching where the live creatures that make up the reefs are dying off. And so when they bleach, the reefs turn white, which looks nice, but it's not good for the reef.
Yes, exactly. That perfect synopsis. And, you know, that's a climate change related effect, sounds like. Hmm. So that's a global effect, right? Mm-hmm. So there are these two researchers, John Bruno and Elizabeth Selig at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, that were wondering if the local management, these underwater parks called marine protected areas, or MPAs, mm-hmm. is the lingo,
oh, yeah.
in the biz, mm-hmm. whether those those parks actually help protect coral when they are facing all of these sort of global threats, like acidification, like coral bleaching, and, you know,
right. So these water parks, they're not setting up water filtration systems going into that part of the ocean and cooling.
Right. You can't rope off those problems.
Right. You kind of rope in. So this is something that they just – but they do keep people from fishing in there and from going in with motorboats or what have
Dropping
you.
Dropping their anchors, right. Doing dynamite fishing, all that kind of thing. So can these parks help coral? And the answer is, after looking at 8,000 surveys from over the last 40 years from all over the world – so yes, they can sort of modestly help coral survive. And the way they did this was by looking at this group of surveys, and the way that you survey coral is by seeing how much coral is covering the ocean floor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called coral cover percentage.
Yeah. No, it's really great. There's some fantastic pictures from under the ocean. But actually, you just mentioned something that's creating a fantastic image for me. Let's go out and do with some dynamite and go fishing? what is that about?
I know. This is a kind of amazing story, I think. People are still, in some parts of the world, fishing by throwing sticks of dynamite into the water and then stunning the fish to collect them. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously it's not the
sounds
most
like
eco-friendly.
A challenge. Yeah, no, it sounds like you have to be a lot of skill involved in that. 3, 2, 1, boom. Okay, there's a fish. All right. Well, all right. It's a great video. I've seen it. You should. Where do we find it?
So we find it on the website at sciencefriday.com. And one little plug, another reason to look at this video is to see one of coral's biggest threats, which are these spiny starfish called crown of thorns. And there's video footage of these invasive outbreaks of these starfish, which,
you know,
they're scary.
You know what my favorite coral is? The okay coral. Okay.
I'm glad you got that in there,
yeah,
Joe.
Yeah, I had to work it in. Okay, well, Flora Lichtman, thank you very much. Flora is the digital media producer for Science Friday.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay. This program is over, or at least this hour of this program is over. It's produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, who you just heard from, is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our science arts producer. Aleshu Bayak, rhymes with kayak, is Spanish language producer. Our intern is Ariel Bleicher. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street. The Science Friday suite is room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or, of course, you can send email. That address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's programs. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. For NPR in New York, I'm Joe Palca.
Joining me now in the studio is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, you're just back from reporting on the earthquake in Haiti. Give us a sense of how much stronger today's quake in Chile was compared to that one in Haiti.
Well, today's quake was an 8.8 versus a 7.0, and the numbers may not seem that different, but actually in terms of energy, it's enormous. That's about 500 times more energy released in this earthquake in Chile than compared with Haiti. However, that's only one measure. Obviously, the Haitian earthquake did so much damage, and there are a couple of reasons for that, one of which is that the energy from that earthquake was very heavily concentrated, and it was extremely close to Port-au-Prince, the capital city. So it was very, very close to structures. Many millions of people were really within intense shaking zones. This was a much more diffuse earthquake. You talk about an epicenter, but I was talking to a geologist who said, you should really think of this as sort of like a sausage-shaped thing that ruptured down there. It was very, very broadly spread out. And so the energy, even though a tremendous amount of energy came out, there wasn't anyone that close by. And obviously, there were still deaths and still destruction of property, but nothing compared with Haiti, where everyone was right on top of that fault. And in fact, where people weren't expecting an earthquake at all. And of course, we've all heard the stories about how badly constructed
Port-au-Prince was.
Yeah. And it's a very different story in Chile.
This same region of Chile was the site of one of the most powerful, the most powerful, actually, earthquake in recorded history. This is in 1960, a 9.5. Explain, what is it about this part of the world that causes these massive quakes?
Well, what's going on here is essentially continental drift, or plate tectonics, as the geologists prefer to call it. And basically what's happening is you've got the Nazca Plate, which is under the Pacific Ocean, trying to move east. And what's east of it is already South America.
Right.
So it's basically running into South America, and it has no place to go but down. So what happens is the continental crust slides underneath. And it's actually the reason that the Andes Mountains exist, because over a long period of time, the mountains get pushed up, the crust gets pushed up. So you're seeing the effects of that on a long-term basis. On a short-term basis, what this really means, though, is that as these stresses accumulate, every so often the stresses get too much, and bang, something slips underground, large areas, as we saw today sometimes, and you get these tremendous earthquakes.
And bigger than anywhere else.
Well, there are certainly quakes of about this magnitude that have happened. Indonesia wasn't quite this big, but it was a very large earthquake. In Alaska, there have been other places where you get large, large earthquakes. But certainly this is one of the most seismically active parts of the planet.
Richard, let me ask you about the tsunami threat. I mean, because obviously people living in coastal areas along the Pacific have been warned all across the Pacific to evacuate, to go to higher ground. These waves move incredibly fast over these vast distances. Explain why some earthquakes cause, you know, these waves and others don't.
Well, you need an earthquake of a certain magnitude to do this. You need, generally speaking, a really powerful earthquake such as this one to generate a tsunami. And what's happening is you're basically jolting the seafloor with an earthquake like this. And you can also, by the way, accomplish the same thing with a giant underwater landslide. That's another way you can generate a tsunami. But these earthquake tsunamis are just, you need that super strong jolt. And once you've jolted it, it's just like, dropping, pushing yourself in the bathtub or something. You create a wave, and the wave just takes off, and it's the energy just gets carried across the ocean. We've been fortunate in this circumstance that basically Chile is really far away from many of the places that are in danger. So there's been just ample time to warn people that there could be potential of disaster. I think what we're also seeing is, the good news is that you're not necessarily going to have widespread destruction from this. It came and went through New Zealand without apparent effect, and so on. And so you don't really know. You can't measure very exactly how a tsunami wave is going to affect things. But at least we knew that there was a potential.
Richard, could an earthquake this big ever hit the U.S.?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it could. There's a very similar circumstances up in the Pacific Northwest, around Washington State and Oregon. There have been earthquakes of this nature in the historical record, not that were measured by instruments, but this sort of thing can definitely happen. It has happened in the past, and it will inevitably happen in the future, but not necessarily, tomorrow or a decade or even a century from now.
That's NPR science correspondent Richard Harris here in the studio with me. Richard, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
It's been a tough winter for Florida's tomato crop. A devastating freeze last month wiped out production by 70%. The state provides almost all of the tomatoes consumed in the U.S. during this time of year. Farmers are struggling, and soon consumers will notice it too. Luis Hernandez of member station WGCU has the story.
Wintertime is not usually a cold time in Southwest Florida, but farmers have spent the past few weeks trying to protect their crops from unusual freezing weather. Late on a recent evening, Jose Cruz Vidari waves a flashlight at a thermostat posted at the end of a row of tomatoes. It reads 41 degrees, and much colder temperatures are expected in several hours. Vidari's the foreman for Felda Tomato Growers, a 500-acre operation in Collier County. He lost some of his crop during the last freeze and doesn't want it to happen again.
We're a little hurt right now. And with all this cold weather, it ain't helping us any. We're hoping to overcome this, and maybe it'll help us here to recover what we lost.
Florida's January freeze is estimated to have destroyed more than $400 million worth of crops, most of it tomatoes. Vidari says he's not taking any chances this time around. As he watches workers and tractors spray a wax-like chemical to help insulate the plants, he says he's worried.
Yeah, it's a little personal to me. You know, I'm hoping not just for us, but every farmer to make some money so we can keep our work, you know, we keep working.
It's more than just farmers who are concerned. In Immokalee, an agricultural community east of Naples, hundreds of migrant workers struggle to pay rent, utilities, and put food on the table. Lines in front of soup kitchens and churches are often hundreds of people long. Local businesses like Primo Supermarket have seen customers dwindle. Market owner John Ahmad says this is normally his busiest time, but it's the worst he's seen in more than a decade.
Our mornings are really bad. They used to be, we start off the day really good because everybody would come here to get their bread, their coffee, their juice. But we don't see that anymore because no one's working, you know.
Ahmad's store is also a popular pickup and drop-off spot for farm workers. He notes that buses still come in the morning, but leave only half full. Businesses which rely on tomatoes have begun to notice the shortage. Tina Fitzgerald is the produce director at Independence Purchasing Cooperative, which buys produce for Subway sandwich shops. She says franchise owners are paying more for tomatoes, and that means customers will soon notice a difference.
Because there's literally no product left in Florida, and there will not be any available until about mid-April, so we're going to have to source solely from Puerto Rico and Mexico.
Fitzgerald says the shape and size of tomatoes may change for a while, but the quality will remain high. Other fast food restaurants are struggling too. Burger King has signs posted at some restaurants warning customers of the tomato shortage. Back in Immokalee, in the dark cabin of his truck, foreman Jose Cruz Vidari calls the farm's owner. Vidari plans to come back to the fields in the middle of the night to check the temperatures again. He says he hopes the weather will warm up soon or the season could be a total loss. For NPR News, I'm Luis Hernandez in Fort Myers, Florida.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
In Antarctica, you'll find 90% of the world's glacial ice. But new research from the U.S. Geological Survey shows that every ice front in the southern part of the Antarctic Peninsula is retreating. Jane Ferrigno is the lead author of that new report. She says scientists have known for a while that some of the peninsula's ice shelves are breaking up.
That started at least a decade ago in the northern part of the peninsula. But we looked at all the ice fronts on the peninsula from north to south. In the southern area, we're finding that all the ice fronts are retreating. In the northern part of the peninsula, the majority of ice fronts are retreating. And that's something we neither expected but we're highly interested in finding that out.
Now, the peninsula, the area where this research was focused on, is sort of like the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, what does it tell us about larger trends?
The fact that the ice shelves are changing on the peninsula is a significant signal that global change, climate warming, is affecting the ice cover of Antarctica. It's affecting first the area that's towards the north, that's slightly warmer, but the effect of the warming has traveled from the northern part of the peninsula to the southern part of the peninsula, where it's colder. Our next concern is to see exactly what's happening in the continent itself. We've seen some changes there, but we need to look closely and see what else might be happening.
Give us a sense of how much ice has been lost over the past, say, 10 years.
I think I'll go back 20 years. And in the last 20 years, I would say at least 20,000 square kilometers of ice has been lost. And that's comparable to an area somewhere between the state of Texas and the state of Alaska.
So about the size of the state of Texas in terms of ice has been lost in the past 20 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Can we measure the consequences, you know, here in North America? I mean, have we been able to see ocean levels rise as a result?
Well, this is a fairly small amount of ice when you consider the whole Antarctic continent consists of about 13 million square kilometers of ice.
I mean, it sounds so dramatic, the size of Texas, right?
It is very dramatic, and it is larger than the size of Texas. But when you consider the entire Antarctic ice sheet, it's still a fairly minimal amount. But the thing that we're really interested in seeing is that this is a sort of a red flag, because if the warming continues, if the retreat continues, if the amount of ice on the continent starts to flow into the water, then there will be substantial impact to the sea level.
That's Jane Ferrigno. She's a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jane Ferrigno, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.